This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
By likening the current legal system to apartheid law, he's basically saying that the law is invalid. So he is still, as he was all along, claiming that he has the right to do whatever he wants, and anybody who claims otherwise is simply biased or an apartheid agent against him.
That was Kathy Powell, a law professor at the University of Cape Town, on former President Jacob Zuma disobeying a court order. Details coming up. Also, a study indicates that Africa is slated to hold 13 national elections this year. And Nigerians are ignoring a mask mandate by President Muhammadu Buhari as the country faces a second wave of COVID-19. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Afrobarometer, a nonpartisan African research institution, finds that 7 of 10 Africans aspire to live under democratic governments. A greater majority reject authoritarian or autocratic rule, presidents for life, and military rule. According to a study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, Africa is slated to hold 13 national elections this year. New U.S. President Joe Biden stressed that democracy is a core value in U.S. foreign policy and that he would convene a global summit for democracy. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi which African countries could witness a move towards democracy and how U.S.-African relations could be reshaped based on democracy.
Today, nearly all African countries hold elections of some type. However, the caliber and fairness of these elections varies greatly, and reflective of the democratic backsliding that we've seen in recent years, a third of this year's elections are expected to be little more than for show. In fact, these elections are taking place on a very uneven playing field, situations where opposition candidates are restricted from campaigning, sometimes they're arrested, there's violence exacted against them or their supporters by the security services. The press is barred from covering these opposition candidates. Electoral commissions may be partisan and may even be tolerating vote rigging. And courts may be politicized when appeals are made. And so all of these things contribute to really a staged electoral process. And, you know, we're seeing that, I think, in an increasing number of countries. And this year, we have cases arguably in Uganda, the Republic of Congo, Chad, Benin, and Djibouti, where that's happening. And this comes on the heels of recent elections we've seen in Tanzania and Guinea, where similarly directed outcomes were generated. Now, you know, it's important to keep in mind, too, that in many of these cases, we're also seeing leaders circumventing term limits. And this is contributing to maintaining in power of some of Africa's longest serving leaders. You know, that said, there are a number of other elections on the continent that are going to be free and fair, where there's genuine competition of ideas, and it'll be conducted in a transparent process. And, you know, these we're expecting to see in Niger, in Cabo Verde, Sao Tome and Principe, and Gambia, among hopefully others.
President Biden stressed that democracy is a core value in U.S. foreign policy, and he would convene a global summit for democracy, and the invited countries will be expected to arrive with a basket of commitments in three major areas. One, fighting corruption. Two, defending against authoritarianism. And three, advancing human rights on the national, regional, and global levels. How could this approach impact U.S. relations with African countries?
Well, most importantly, I think it signals that democratic credentials of African governments will be an important factor in how the U.S. engages with the continent. And I think it's notable that the Biden administration is talking about connecting the national to the regional and the global. So this means that there's a recognition that democratic norms and human rights are reinforced regionally. You know, there are different standards that need to be upheld, and that these in turn shape how transnational challenges on security, on climate, on public health can be addressed more collaboratively. I think it's also notable that the Biden administration seems to be signaling that democracy is not just a valuable goal in itself, but it also supports other objectives, such as security and socioeconomic development. You know, in Africa, 3/4 of all of the conflicts are taking place in countries with authoritarian governments. You know, 90% of the refugees and internally displaced people originate in countries with governments that are not free and fair. We've seen multiple studies show that transparency and better governments contribute to better development outcomes, such as on education, health, food security. So I think the Biden administration is believing that by giving greater emphasis to democratic legitimacy, it can make greater progress on a whole host of other priorities.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. Will Jacob Zuma go to jail? That is the question that opposition parties and political analysts in South Africa are asking. It comes after the former president disobeyed an order from the highest court in the land compelling him to testify at the Commission of Inquiry into Corruption. Zuma is accused of appointing cronies to loot state enterprises on his behalf of billions of rands when he led South Africa from 2009 to 2018. Darren Taylor reports.
The apartheid government imprisoned Zuma for 10 years on Robben Island for his role in the fight to liberate South Africa. Now he's accusing the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture and the Constitutional Court of targeting him, just like the white supremacists did.
It's simply the logical conclusion of the attitude that he's shown so far. Remember, he did walk out of the commission without permission, which is already a crime. It's an offence under the Commissions Act.
Cathy Powell is Professor of Law at the University of Cape Town. In a letter to the commission explaining his refusal to give evidence, Zuma writes that he's the target of propaganda, vilification, and falsified claims, all because he wanted to transform South Africa and give more economic power to black citizens.
By likening the current legal system to apartheid law, he's basically saying that the law is invalid. So he is still, as he was all along, claiming that he has the right to do whatever he wants, and anybody who claims otherwise is simply biased or an apartheid agent against him.
The commission's heard witness after witness claiming that most of the money the former president allegedly plundered ended up in his pockets or those of his friends, and especially went into the bank accounts of two businessmen brothers from India, AJ and Atul Gupta. Zuma suggests that the commission and the Constitutional Court, both of which he helped establish as a senior ruling party official, have been captured by white capital.
It's not in itself an offence to say nasty things about the justice system. I think that would probably be protected by freedom of expression. But you would expect him to actually back up what he's saying with some facts. Now, those allegations that he makes are so empty. And I find it almost comical because the whole point of the
Constitution... It's especially funny, says Powell, given that the Constitutional Court has previously ruled in favor of Zuma by ordering the commission to treat the ex-president just like it would any other witness.
Now, Zuma's claiming he's getting especially unfavorable treatment.
She says should Zuma refuse to appear before the inquiry or refuse to answer its questions or commit perjury, he could be jailed.
The maximum sentence provided for those is 6 months, which is not very much, but there's also the option of a fine. And of course, if he gets a separate sentence for each of those offences, it could add up a bit. There is also the option of imprisoning Zuma until he agrees to testify. This has to be done in 8-day increments, but can be carried on more or less indefinitely. So if Zuma really wants to be a hero for the struggle that he thinks he is waging, he is possibly going to spend a very long time in prison.
Zuma declined to speak with VOA instead sending a statement saying, if my stance is considered to be a violation of their law, then let their law take its course. I do not fear being arrested. I do not fear being convicted, nor do I fear being incarcerated. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Carter Center NGO says the number of new cases of Guinea worm infection dropped by half last year to 27 infections in six countries. It's part of the last push in a decades-long effort to eradicate an excruciatingly painful waterborne parasite that once infected over 3.5 million people in 21 countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. In a two-part series, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Adam Weiss, director of the Guinea Worm Eradication Program at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Weiss began by describing the beast and what it does.
It's a one-meter-long worm that is one of the nastiest parasites humankind has met. You get infected from water, contaminated with this worm. It lives inside your body. You have no idea that you're actually infected until about 1 year later, when this worm emerges from your body and creates a painful blister and subsequent lesion and can debilitate you even months at a time. You can't walk around. You're not able to go to your farm, go to school. So it not only impacts individuals and their ability to live a free life, but also impacts the household, but also their community, as they're not able to provide for one another.
I've seen photographs of guinea worms being pulled out of nipples and many other excruciating intimate parts of the body. It's been compared to the pain of childbirth and worse.
Yes, one of our great friends in South Sudan has said that childbirth, while painful, has a start and a stop, whereas guinea worm is an unrelenting pain, and very stoic men will shed more than a few tears as guinea worm is extracted from their body. And this is something that people should fear.
I understand that animals can also get infected with guinea worm.
Over the last few years, we have seen domestic dogs mostly, but also a few baboons become infected with guinea worm. And not only is guinea worm transmitted through drinking infected water, but also through mostly small fish, whereby if you eat those fish without properly cooking or curing them, you may also become infected with guinea worm. So although it's added an additional layer of complexity in this last mile effort to eradicate guinea worm, it's also reinforced our partnership in making sure that that information is well understood at the community and individual level for action.
And yet the number of guinea worm cases has been in stark decline since 1986, when the Carter Center first set out to eradicate this horror.
Yeah, there were 3.5 million people annually suffering from guinea worm disease. And so you can imagine the economic toll that that took, particularly in some of the heaviest hit countries like Nigeria and Ghana, where entire communities would be down with guinea worm and they would not be able to farm food for the next year. In Mali, guinea worm became known as the disease of the empty granary because they weren't able to have food the next year if they had guinea worm. And so across more than 21 countries, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, but also a few countries in the Middle East and in Asia, that has been dwindled down. Only six countries reported infections last year, and only 27 people had guinea worm in this very difficult endgame.
How does that feel?
It feels great. However, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. The end game is eradication, which means complete extinction of the parasite as quickly as possible.
There are so many kinds of stakeholders involved.
All the more reason to take a multifaceted, multisectoral approach to the engagement process, both at the individual level, knowing that there are people you need to connect with one-on-one, really understand their challenges, and still at the same time, look at it from a community perspective and help them to see the value of that for their community. They are the backbone of implementing surveillance, which is the active looking every day for guinea worm. And despite the pandemic, they've been able to continue to operate. And we've been able to be creative to ensure that they get the backstop support, both local and otherwise, to continue to carry out their work day to day. And understanding that this is actually a global effort, And it's important that we remind each other that we're all interconnected in this, and my fellow human's plight is my plight. And so if we don't work together, we're not going to be able to achieve what we're looking for.
Adam Weiss, director of the Guinea Worm Eradication Program at the Carter Center, was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Nigerians are ignoring a mask mandate by President Muhammadu Buhari as the country faces a second wave of COVID-19. Deaths and infection rates have spiked as authorities contemplate shutting down some major cities to curb the pandemic. For more, International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Dr. Anthony Eby, assistant professor of medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C.
It is frightening because, one, either they don't understand that the disease, COVID-19, is now everywhere. It's not a white man's disease. It's not a Western disease. It's everybody's disease. So it's in Nigeria, people are dying. Two, they also do not understand the role that mask wearing plays in decreasing the spread from one person to the other. Again, that comes back to what we were saying earlier about the role of government in marketing, in properly advertising this, improperly educating people, improperly having this highly spirited campaign to educate the people. Not wearing the mask is a bad idea. To advise our people to wear the mask, explain to them why they wear it. I think Nigerians are very reasonable people. If you explain to them, they will understand.
The government is also contemplating shutting down major cities like Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and even Rivers State. Is this an effective strategy?
These are high-density areas in the country. So obviously, with the high-density population, the rate of spread is much, much higher than in villages or places where the population is sparse. So theoretically, therefore, it makes sense to say, okay, let's shut down these high-density areas and decrease transmission. But the question, therefore, will be, for how long will you shut down these places? Two, what relief are you providing to people during this shutdown so that they can obey the instruction? So the government has to come up with a well-thought-out plan to say, okay, this will be for a two-week period, and we are doing it because of A, B, C, D. And two, during this period of shutdown, we will be able to provide some food subsidy, because food is one of the most important things, you know, everybody needs, to every family in need below a certain level of income, and then make it available to them. This will increase compliance. This may help in temporarily decreasing the transmission, but it has to be well thought of and planned and effectively explained to the people.
Nigerian health authorities report that the second wave is taking a huge toll on not just mortality, but also threatening the nation's medical facilities. Do you think Nigeria was taken unawares by the second wave, or just lack of planning to anticipate that there will be a second wave?
I think it's a combination of various factors, you know, the two things you mentioned and others. It looked like initially most people believed that, oh, COVID does not exist in Africa or in the Western Africa because of the heat. Heat will kill it and all those kinds of comments. But we know that is not true. And I'm not sure we have had very effective grassroots campaign, not just from Abuja, Lagos, Port Harcourt. It has to be at the village level. It has to be at the market level. It has to be at the church level to let people know what is happening, what we can do to all help ourselves. And we are all in it together. And if we all take steps together, we can contain this virus, at least decrease the number of deaths. People are really dying, and it is therefore not reasonable to pretend it's not happening. We already did not have any significant healthcare set up before. This will be a further devastation of whatever little thing we have. And I imagine this will be a wake-up call for all governments at all levels to really look into the health sector.
That's Dr. Anthony Eby, assistant professor of medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine. He spoke with my colleague Chinedu Ofor from Washington. Five vehicles crashed in a highway in western Uganda last night, killing at least 32 people and injuring five others, according to multiple accounts of the accident. Irene Nakasita, Communications officer of the Uganda Red Cross Society said today the accident occurred on Fort Portal Kasisi Highway, a narrow roadway under construction in the Kasisi district. Initial reports indicate the speeding truck carrying a coffin for a burial collided with another car before a third vehicle carrying several people slammed into the pileup. Two other drivers then lost control and rammed into the wrecked vehicles. Police are still sorting out the circumstances of the accident in Uganda, which has more than 2,000 road accident deaths annually, ranking it among the countries with the most traffic fatalities. Police arrested the former director of the Malawi National Examination Board and three other top officials last night in connection with massive leakage of Malawi schools' certificate examination, the final tests for secondary schools. The Education Ministry cancelled the exams in November after they were widely shared on social media. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
National Police spokesperson James Kadadzera says MANEB's director Gerard Chiunda was arrested alongside Chief Examination Development Officer Ishmael Faki, Chief Examination Security Officer Joseph Chilombe, and Head of Security Owen Kunto.
In fact, they have been arrested on the allegations that they failed to exercise due care and attention in relation to the security of national examination materials, and also that they failed to take reasonable steps for the security of national examination materials.
Kadadzera said the men are expected to appear in court for charges after police concluded taking statements from them. The arrest comes months after President Lazarus Chakwera called for a thorough investigation into the examination leakage.
I'm therefore giving the Malawi National Examination Board until the end of this month to remove the top management of MANEB on account of this gross failure and replace it with a new team that will conduct the most credible examinations that Malawi has ever had.
Chiunda earlier told a news conference that he believes the leakage of the exam papers came from his office. A preliminary investigation by police and the MANEB board blamed a security lapse at the MANEB head office. It faulted MANEB administration for employing six security officers to guard the examination storeroom instead of the recommended 15 officers. Education expert Steve Shara says Malawi can prevent future leaks by tightening security.
So I think it's about really putting in place systems right from the management itself all the way to the schools where the exams are taken. We have managed this process before in a successful way.
For the rescheduled exams in January, the government deployed military and intelligence officers to provide security. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.